It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 90 for Friday, the 24th of August, 2012. On the show this week, we wish a fond farewell to a great oak of the Wired.co.uk forest, as well as the game studio that brought us the best ways to get lemmings to commit suicide. Also, we'll discover the 21st century method of monitoring the global position of sharks in real time and ask the question, are games getting easier because developers are getting greedy? All that and more coming up. Ahoy hoy, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk, joining me for the last time ever, news editor, a Duncan of Gear.
Hello.
And of course, our associate editor, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
We're doing a video version of this show to celebrate the Duncan's passing into Sweden. Duncan's leaving us, of course, regular listeners of the show will know this. It's a real shame, Duncan. You have graced us with your height, your knowledge, your wisdom. Liv, what else has Duncan given us?
That's about it, I think. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure being a part of this podcast for so long. I have loved it so very, very much.
Yes, and sure you should have. It's been a fantastic couple of years. But we've got a big show to get to, and we're going to start by the fact that Sony has shut the Wipeout developer Studio Liverpool. This was the original publisher of Lemmings and the Wipeout game series that's sadly been closed. It was once called Psygnosis. Do you remember those guys?
Yeah.
They had the owl logo.
A really weird, like, 80s techno owl logo.
It was a hoot. It was acquired by Sony in the mid-90s, ultimately becoming Sony's Liverpool studio, after being originally founded in 1984 to develop games for the Amiga. I think this is really sad. Lemmings, they published it. They didn't develop it, I don't think. I think they just developed.
It's definitely published. Sad to see kind of like historic game studios being shut down.
What's it been making recently?
Well, it's been making... Well, it actually made Wipeout quite recently, because there's a Wipeout 20-something on the Vita, on the PS Vita.
Yeah.
And it's really quite good.
Didn't they work on some sports games as well, some football games?
Historically, though, they did stuff like G-Police, which was a great game. Colony Wars was really good. They published Lemmings, of course. And what was the other one they did? Was it Lemmings that they did? They were that Rockstar. They became Rockstar, didn't they? They did Grand Theft Auto. I think they were. I think they were called something else back then.
Possibly.
Anyway, Star there's North. A statement from a spokesperson for Sony said, quote, by focusing our investment plans on other studios that are currently working on exciting new projects, we would be in a stronger position to offer the best possible content for our consumers. Now, I think that's a nice way of saying they weren't doing as well as some of Sony's other studios.
Perhaps. But, you know, it's still sad to see jobs go in games in a place like Liverpool, you know?
I do know. Yeah, it's sad. Well, let's move on. Duncan, Arctic ice caps, they're setting record-breaking, melting...
Yeah, this is a proper Duncan Gear story, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the Arctic ice cap, which some of you will be familiar with, in fact, most of you will probably be familiar with, it's looking like we're going to break the record for the greatest melt this year, which means there is going to be a very, very small amount of ice left at the top of the world, and everything else will melt. And of course, in the winter, it's going to refreeze again, but every summer, it will kind of melt to a minimum, and it looks like that minimum is going to be the biggest minimum, smallest minimum ever, greatest minimum ever.
Yeah, so what happens when it melts? Does the water not just drain away?
Well, I mean, so the Arctic ice cap actually floats on top of the sea. Unlike Antarctica, which is a continent underneath, it all floats on top of the sea. So it displaces all the water underneath it. So none of the fact that there is ice melting here doesn't actually raise sea level in any way more than a block of ice sitting in your drink will raise the temperature of your drink. But will raise the level of your drink. But it's important because when a cube of ice is in your drink, you can stick a temperature, a thermometer in there, and it will stay at 0 degrees Celsius, which is obviously the melting point of ice. And it will stay there, and it will stay there, because all the heat energy that's being sucked into this liquid is going into melting that ice. Now, when that ice then disappears, suddenly all that energy is no longer being used to melt that ice, and the temperature will rocket upwards. So when we, you know, because it's then going into raising the temperature of the water, so, or Coke or whatever else you like to drink. And so when you, in the Arctic, what happens when we do have, and it's looking inevitable now that we will have an iceless summer at some point in the next few decades, It means that suddenly all the energy that was going into melting that ice will suddenly go into raising the water temperatures there. And that could have dramatic effects on ecosystems, on ocean currents. We don't really know what's going to happen there yet. So this is concerning.
So what sort of scale are we looking at here? I mean, you say this is the biggest melt ever. What does that actually look like?
Well, the last record was in 2007. In 2007, there was a big sort of pattern of high pressure over the central Arctic Ocean and low pressure over the North Eurasian coast. And that meant that the ice cap shrank to a record low of 4.25 million square kilometers, which is still a huge, huge yeah. area. It's the Arctic is big. But this year, even though conditions up there haven't been quite as consistent, we haven't had these patterns of high pressure there. Still, the rate of loss is, on average, about 100,000 square kilometers a day of yeah. ice is kind of just melting around there. And I think on August 13th, which is maybe about a week before we're recording this podcast, the remaining ice area in the Arctic was about 5 million square kilometers, which is it's more than 2.5 million square kilometers below the average minimum extent of ice between 1979 and 2000 for the same date. So we've still got 2 weeks to go. It's going to be probably the lowest ever. Like, even if it stopped today, we'd be at the third lowest ice level in the record, and we've still got another 2 weeks of melt to go. So it's looking very likely that we're going to set a new record.
And are there any positives to this huge amount of ice melting?
Well, it depends on what you consider as a positive. I mean, it helps shipping up around there. That's I guess, the main thing. China has been sending vessels along Arctic routes in August. So instead of having to sail all the way around through the Indian Ocean, around the tip of South Africa, and then up the west coast of Africa, you can just like pop over the top of Russia, and that cuts the route length to Europe by about 40%, which is a significant amount.
So I mean, that cuts roundabouts.
Yeah, I mean, and in a way, that cuts shipping emissions as well, because yeah. vessels are using less fuel to go around. But I mean, that doesn't really make up for the fact that suddenly there's less ice there. Germany and Russia have already long been sending ships kind of around there, but we will definitely see an increase in kind of shipping along this northeastern passage.
Well, let's leave our cold northeastern passage and start talking about the passages of mosquitoes, Liv, because you've been talking about
yes.
mating plugs. I love these.
I have indeed. Now, conventional methods to prevent malaria, a lot of them seem to involve insecticides. So you put like spray on your skin, or you sit underneath nets to prevent the mosquitoes from coming in and attacking. But a lot of mosquitoes are getting resistant to these insecticides. So lots of researchers are looking at different ways to control mosquito populations and therefore control malaria. And a team of chemists at Yale University are focusing on a very specific mating mechanism that is found in mosquitoes.
A mating mechanism?
Yeah.
This sounds promising.
It does sound promising. And this is what happens is when mosquitoes have sex, the male mosquito inserts a mating plug to seal its...
a what, sorry?
A mating plug. It's just a plug. A kind of a coagulated plug into the woman's
area.
Mating chamber to make sure that his sperm gets stuck inside and he gets reproductive success.
And I guess other mosquitoes can't then...
So it blocks it off from other yeah. mosquitoes from penetrating the female mosquito.
It's not very romantic, is it? Let's be honest.
It's not, but I don't think mosquito sex is that romantic. It takes place in the air, very short, very, very, very fast.
Yeah, it sounds quite fun.
Like an airplane bathroom.
yes. But anyway, there's a specific enzyme that's required in the seminal fluid of the mosquito to coagulate and make this plug, which is pretty gross, but I guess it's like the way a scab would heal when you cut yourself. And so a team led by a chemist called Richard Baxter are actually really targeting in on this specific enzyme to make sure that the mosquitoes can't create these little plugs and therefore can't breed, and therefore the female mosquitoes, who are actually the ones who carry the malaria and bite humans, will also die out. It's a kind of interesting mechanism whereby you target the males, but then they can't breed, and therefore you don't breed little baby mosquitoes.
I see.
And this is an interesting approach, because this technique has been used really successfully. It's called sterile insect technique, and it's completely eradicated the screwworm fly in the US. And this is a horrible fly that lays its larvae in animals and then eats their flesh while they're alive, and they eventually die.
And I suppose the really positive thing is that it doesn't use insecticide.
Yeah, again, it doesn't use insecticide. Extra chemicals are always a bad thing, and especially when mosquitoes are building up resistance. So I think it's really interesting. They haven't actually found the right kind of formulation to make sure that these mosquitoes don't produce this enzyme. However, when they do, they'll breed them in captivity and then release them into the wild so that they breed with the wild ones, and hopefully that will reduce their population significantly.
Is this mating plug used because this reproduction
sorry talking of mating plugs
happens in the air? Because it's not, it doesn't seem common with other species, although don't
no,
spiders
there is,
do it.
Some spiders that do it. I think it's quite common in a few different species to try and prevent other males from getting them, especially when they've got such short lives and there's so few attempts at getting their sperm into lady.
With spiders, isn't it that their sort of their organs bit. Break off?
In one spider, I can't remember which spider it was.
We wrote
about it in one of the podcasts, but there's one spider that will castrate itself and leave its genitals, if they're called spider genitals, I'm not entirely sure, in the lady as a kind of plug in itself.
A sort of organic plug.
Yeah.
No, it's all organic, really, isn't
it? Yeah.
I'll file this under things to learn from the insect world and
be afraid of.
Deploy in the human world. I just think there might be a use for this.
How would you do that?
I don't want to think. That's fascinating. But Duncan, I want to talk about SharkNet.
Of course you want to talk about SharkNet.
Yes.
So this is SharkNet is an app, and it lets you track the positions of sharks in real time off the Pacific coast.
Okay. And why would one want to do this apart from the obvious not getting eaten?
Well, not getting eaten, basically. But scientists can also use it to kind of find out more about shark habitats and how they travel and all kinds of other things. It's this team of marine biologists who've put it together from Stanford University, and they created this app which uses signals from a series of autonomous robots, kind of like, I guess, the equivalent of unmanned drones, but on the sea rather than in the air, to alert users to the location of nearby sharks when they receive a signal. They built this big wireless network off the coast of San Francisco by putting data receivers onto buoys, and then that didn't kind of like provide enough data. So what they need to do to fill that out is they brought in wave gliders, which are these wave-powered and solar-powered autonomous robots, and they built transceivers onto those as well. And by doing this, they were able to populate over quite a large area a network of places where they can kind of receive data from these fish and animals. And so what they're doing is there's a bunch of kind of like whales and seals and seabirds and turtles that are fitted with acoustic tags, and they've been fitted by these tags by a project over a series of years. And these tags, as they come within 300 meters of one of these receivers, either a robot or a buoy, it takes that acoustic signal and it uses it to calculate a location to where it is, and then the app that you can download to your phone gets a live feed off that network, and every time a shark tag is picked up, it pushes an alert to your phone saying, watch out, there's a shark and it's here. And then it pops it up on a map.
So it relies on all of the sharks being tagged?
Yes, this is the slight problem with it.
That's quite a huge problem.
Yeah, it's a big problem, because there's quite frequently sharks that that migrate quite a long distance, and so they might get missed in the tagging program or something like that.
Well,
they might have
eaten the tagger.
Also possible. So it's not the be-all and end-all of we know where all the sharks in the world are, not far from it, but it does give us some better idea about the patterns of how they travel and stuff like that, and if there is one that comes nearby, you can jump out of the water, I guess.
Yeah. I'd quite like to see this adopted, though, for, you know, bird watching or animal watching. You mentioned seals. I'd like to see if the world's seals were tagged and you wanted to go and find a seal to look at. You could fire up your app, be like, where's the nearest seal to me?
And where is not the nearest shark?
Yeah.
In which case, if yes, seal, no shark, then let's go and check it out.
It's a bit like Badu, but instead of hookups, it's sharks.
It's sharks,
in a way.
Different kind of sharks.
Can you get the app now?
I'm not 100% sure. I believe so. If you can, then you can search in the App Store for, I think it's called SharkNet, N-E-T.
Excellent. And we have a story on Wired.co.uk, OBS.
OBS.
Let's go into space, shall we? Astronauts aboard the International Space Station took a spacewalk earlier this week to hang micrometeoroid debris shields on some of the, I think just one of the station's modules, which will help it basically protect the orbiting laboratory from space junk, which we've talked about actually in quite some detail in the past, like bits of old helmet, which I love the mental image of, alien limbs, but more realistically, bits of like discarded rocket, bits of old satellite, things like that. The thing is, these little tiny bits of debris can cause quite a lot of damage.
They can only be like a centimeter across or something like that, but because of the speeds that they're traveling at,
they are going at like 7 kilometers a second or
more. And there's
no
auto glass for the ISS, is there?
No. There's not. But the thing is, the ISS orbits the Earth at about over 7 kilometers per second. So if you imagine a 10 centimeter bit of old space junk, hat, helmet, whatever, hitting you at 7 kilometers a second, that's going to cause quite the devastation. And in fact, that did almost happen at one point. In January of this year, the crew on the ISS had to do this dodge maneuver to basically avoid a piece of 10 centimeter old satellite. And in 2011, in June, they had to actually get into some evacuation pods because a piece of junk was floating worryingly close to the ISS.
So we've got a number of options, haven't we, to deal with this space junk. And we've covered a few of them before on the podcast. We've talked about
powerful lasers,
shooting lasers into the sky,
using gravity
to knock them out of orbit and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But this is a new one. This is like putting physical shields up on around the modules, correct?
It is, but what's weird is that this is going to be on one of the Russian service modules, whereas the US equivalent part has actually had shields since it launched. So the Russians just didn't have one of these shields on, and now they're installing one.
Okay, so this is kind of like to bring it up to the standards of the rest of the station rather than actually improve things significantly.
Yes, exactly that. But yeah, it's going to be 2.5 centimeters thick on this little Russian thing, and we'll hopefully...
Do we know what it's made out of? Jam? Cheese?
No, I actually don't know what it's made out of.
But bears?
It's going to be on the space station.
Wouldn't it be great if it was made of bears?
Yes, spare parts. It would be fantastic. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to find out why Britain's broadband will not be the best in Europe by 2015.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Welcome back, and welcome to the studio, Ian Steadman.
Hello.
iStead, as I like to call you. Thanks for joining us. You wrote a story story this week after Jeremy Hunt spoke at the Google campus about Britain having the fastest broadband by 2015.
Yes.
What did Hunt say?
What's going on?
Well, this is kind of reiterating something he said in 2010 when the coalition government came in. He said he wanted... the government wanted the UK to have the best broadband in Europe by 2015. And last week he said that he wanted the UK to have the fastest broadband in Europe.
Which is a subtly different thing.
It's slightly different, yeah. And it kind of reflects the fact that in those 2 years, the target has become a bit more realistic. Frankly.
Well, they wanted it to be 24 megabits per second with universal access to at least 2 megabits per second.
Yeah, exactly. 90% of the population should have what they defined as super fast broadband. That's 24 megabits per second. Currently, that's about 2/3 of the population. And that 2/3 of the population happen to be the bits of the country where it makes financial sense to kind of upgrade the infrastructure. The rest are people who live in rural areas or smaller towns where there's just not enough private money to invest in it. And the government's set up this fund where they're going to try and subsidise companies like BT, and actually any community group can apply for this. If you want in your village or town to have super fast broadband, you can apply to the government, and they've got a fund of £850 million, which they're dishing out in sort of small sums to people. £300 million of that, by the way, is coming from the licence fee.
I was going to say, where's that money coming from?
Yeah, mostly it's from the government, from general taxes and stuff, but 300 million is from the license fee. It's been skimmed off the license fee. So part of the cuts that BBC is going through right now are because of this aim of extending broadband access, which makes sense. I mean, the economy kind of relies on it for the future.
What was your story this week focusing on? Because we're trying to move things forward.
Yeah, is it realistic, basically? Yeah. And it kind of, sort of, I mean, it's doable, but it's not likely to happen by 2015.
It's doable for us to be number one in Europe.
No.
Because where do we sit at the moment?
We sit sort of in the top 10-15-ish on some kind of things. I mean, worldwide, we're sort of in the 2025 area. Yeah. But if you look at the countries that are faster than us right now, actually, the countries in Europe that are faster than us right now already have faster than 24 megabits per second. There are countries like Bulgaria and Romania, Lithuania, Latvia, Luxembourg. They're small. And they also have that really fast broadband in large cities and nowhere else. So the average is, of course, going to be very high. Whereas we have broadband over a large area, but it's kind of slower. And it's trying to get up that to speed, so it's a bigger challenge. It costs a lot of money.
But some people do have over, like, 100 meg broadband.
They do.
Not to point fingers at myself again, but yeah. I do. So where's this? This 24 doesn't look that great.
Well, it's not that great. And the reason it's like that is because the way they're upgrading the system, we currently have mostly copper cables that bring you internet in your home. It's the same as your phone line, basically. And the upgrade scheme is kind of replacing... you know those green cabinets on street corners?
Yeah.
Yeah. Building new ones of those with fiber optic cable that goes from the street to your local exchange and then onto the wider network.
And that's called fiber to the cabinet, right?
Yeah, exactly. But the remaining loop is still copper. On short distances, like...
Between the cabinet and your house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Over that short distance, if it's like 10 meters, that's not going to be an issue. You're still going to be able to get like up to 80 megabit per second. It's still really, really fast. But in rural areas where you might be have several kilometers between your local cabinet and your house, you're going to drop below 10 quite quickly. And that's the kind of issue for future-proofing. So, because we might, it's very much conceivable, and I spoke to BT about this, who are doing most of the upgrades, and they said that they expect by 2015 the target of 90% of the population to have 24 megabit per second will be met. But the problem is future-proofing that, because there's fiber to the cabinet, as we just talked about. There's also fiber to the home, which is where fiber goes all the way from the exchange to your house.
But that seems to be the key thing here, is that BT thinks that it's realistic that by 2015, which isn't that long away, 90% of the population will have access to 24 megabits.
At least,
which is over 10 times as fast as what Jeremy Hunt was saying in 2010, everyone should have at least access to.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that actually seems pretty good.
Oh, it is. It is good. It's just, they've kind of subtly scaled back the ambition of it. It's still going to be good. It's just not going to be, you know, the best necessarily on every metric. It's not going to be, the average speed in the UK isn't going to be the fastest in Europe, and it's not going to be the best coverage. But in the kind of balancing act between coverage and speed, it's actually going to be...
So we're not best in any one area, but we're
good. Overall pretty damn good.
We're overall pretty good. Okay. Yeah. So what about the 10% of people, and I'm sure there's probably some of them listening to this podcast, if they can download it on their connections, who are in areas where they can't get anything more than what they've got?
The problem there is that those tend to be houses in really rural areas, like the Scottish Highlands, islands off the coast, places like that.
But Hunter's committed to universal access to 2 megs.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do those people get those 2 megs?
A combination of other technologies beyond fiber optic, things like wireless technologies. BT have been trialing a technology called white space. White space is kind of... As the digital TV switchover happens, there's all this extra TV spectrum that's being left over, and the Ofcom's given them permission to kind of trial broadcasting long-distance Wi-Fi over that, and it's been working quite well.
So it's the signals that were being used to broadcast TV now being used to broadcast internet.
Yeah,
but then there's also this like satellite
as well, which is okay, but has a very high latency
and it takes
a long time.
Very expensive.
And it's expensive. Yeah, these technologies are envisioned as being very much complementary rather than the main thing. The overall aim is to kind of get as many people wired as possible. BT have a huge scheme to get like 100 meg or something down to Cornwall, which is at the moment very, very poorly connected. But by 2015, that remaining 10% is still going to be really, really kind of cut off. Even if they get the 2 meg thing, which is possible, getting beyond that's going to require a lot of investment, because they've spent several billion already upgrading the large cities and towns. That 850 million that's left over for the remaining third of the population, you know, as few people left, the price goes up.
Yeah.
That's why they're left. They're the ones who are being done last, as it were. So it's going to be difficult, basically.
But good news for the majority.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And importantly, Hunt's promise that we're going to have the fastest broadband in Europe by 2015, or the best broadband in Europe in 2015, you're saying that's pretty much impossible.
Yeah, pretty much impossible.
Fair enough.
There's another factor to this, though, which is things like 4G and 3G, and there are more people cutting the cable. I mean,
oh, definitely.
I have a fiber optic cable coming into my house, but there's no...
And you keep talking about it.
It's not a brag.
It's a humble brag.
It's a brag. It is great, though. It's expensive.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's not cheap, but it is worth it. I just sometimes sit and watch stuff download. Like it's great. It comes down like 10 megabytes.
See, I laugh at you, but then I experienced a huge thrill when I sat in a tube station for the first time and tried the Wi-Fi and realized I was getting like 300 meg or something insane
in there. But what I was going to say, though, is that that's the only reason I have a cable coming into my house.
Yeah.
I would like to just go cable free, to go wireless. I don't have a landline. I have a mobile phone.
Yeah.
It would be great for technology to get to the extent that I can get close to my beloved 100 meg, you know, and 4G and the evolution of that, like, you know. We can start getting close for some of the population,
definitely.
I would say.
I'll start taking some videos of my download speeds in Sweden and sending them to you, Nate, to make you jealous.
Well. Well. Ian, thanks ever so much for joining us.
No problem.
A pleasure. I want to talk about death. It's a topic that is very dear to my heart. I've been writing a lot about death this week. I want to ask you something. Do you remember the Tamagotchi?
Yes.
Yes.
Did you have one?
Yes, but quite late on.
Really?
I didn't really have one at the time while it was cool, because I never really had things when they were cool.
Do you have a Tamagotchi, Liv?
I was always about 6 months later.
My younger sister had a Tamagotchi. I think I was a little bit too old.
Bit too cool.
Bit too cool.
I had loads of them. I practically collected them until I was far too old to be playing with them. Mm. There was one called Nano Baby. It was a bit disturbing. Anyway, the reason we're talking about this, Tamagotchis could get diseases from mounting piles of their own waste in the corner of the screen. If you didn't clear it up, they would die. And it caused a lot of controversy at the time because kids were basically getting really emotionally attached and addicted to caring for these pets so that they didn't die, that they would basically get in trouble in school. And it really started receiving mainstream TV coverage when people started opening Tamagotchi creches and daycare and nurseries and things for kids to send their... Go on.
Have you explained actually what a Tamagotchi is for people who don't remember
it? I just assume people listening to Wired know what it is. It was those things, those little toys out of Japan that looked like tiny eggs, had a little dot matrix screen and about three buttons, and you looked after, to begin with, like a little alien that would hatch and grow and eventually it would die. And they were incredibly popular. They sold millions. And death for these things were really... It was kind of a central selling point. In fact, when it launched in the UK in 1996, I think, something like that, journalists invited to a launch party to collect a Tamagotchi were told that if they failed to show up, they would be sent a funeral bill. Like, they were really saying death is a key thing here with that sort of message. But what's quite interesting is how those sorts of games are now still extremely popular today, with things like Mushy Monsters, and there's a game called My Horse on the iPhone, and, you know, even stuff like Farmville and those sorts of games on Facebook and things. But they're so massively different because these things don't die. These pets do not die. And I did a bit of a feature on the site this week to sort of look into why, and, you know, is this symptomatic of something going on in the gaming industry that we've just sort of got rid of death when it comes to casual gaming and things like that. And
so I just gonna, you would like, for example, with My Horse, you'd like to see the horse like get buried in a kind of pool of its own excrement and then decay and
well,
die.
I don't want it to. What I mean is that this is a game where the objective is to look after a horse and care for it, and you have to clean it and you feed it and you raise it and it becomes stronger, and, you know, then you can do show jumping and stuff like that, all that kind of stuff. And half of the problem is that if you don't check in on the horse and just ignore it, it's still fine.
So it's all carrot. No challenge. It's all carrot and no stick, basically.
It's literally all carrot and no stick, because you feed it carrots or can. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sort of.
Anyway, point behind it is that the big difference, I think, between the Tamagotchi and these games is that with the Tamagotchi, you had to buy the Tamagotchi up front. I think they were about 10, 15 quid or something. You bought one, they'd got their money. So if they died, then that's fine, because the developer, Bandai, I think, got their money. Whereas now, these games are free to play, so it doesn't cost any money to play My Horse, for example. But in the game, you want to buy extra food, extra items, you want to raise it by paying with micropayments and things like that.
So it's in the developer's interest to keep you playing as long as possible.
Exactly.
And by your creature dying makes you much less likely to carry on playing.
What if they got illnesses and you have to buy medicine or it dies?
Well, that would be even worse, arguably, because then it's like, we're going to kill your pet unless you get his money.
Yeah.
It's basically virtual blackmail, Liv.
That's correct.
Would be a very sad time for horse ownership in the digital space. But the thing is, the whole reason we're talking about this is because I think that there is a trend that we may start to see. Free-to-play games are not now limited to these kind of casual games on the iPhone and on Facebook. We're really starting to see games like you know, even like World of Warcraft and what was the game, the recent game that was free to play? Not Diablo. Diablo's not free to play, is it?
No, Dota 2 is going to be free to play when it's released later this year.
And the argument is that developers now want people to start playing their games early, and then they get to a certain level, and then they start having to pay or subscribe or buy in-game items and things like that. And if you look at the trend that has happened with Tamagotchi into casual gaming now, and think, well, if developers don't want to put kids and gamers off playing their games and spending money by having the threat of death or that sort of real challenge where you have to avoid it, does that not suggest in a way that games are becoming, are going to just become incredibly unchallenging because developers don't want to risk anyone switching off because their characters died? And
I mean, not dying is only one form of challenge, isn't it? Like, there are also challenges like meeting achievement goals and things like that. You know, in My Horse, you have to do show jumping. That's a challenge. So I don't think it removes the aspect of challenge completely from the experience.
But I just wonder whether it's the wrong message. I mean, I spoke to a whole bunch of people for this feature. I spoke to Michael Acton-Smith at Mind Candy. They do Mushy Monsters, and the people behind My Horse. But there was one in particular, a guy called Darren Phyllis, who is the general director of a Mexican toy company called Distroller. And he said, quote, "We don't want the child or parent to feel they're not getting value for money, as it's an investment. We want to ensure our customers are having a great experience and want to buy more dolls." These are sort of the virtual dolls that go along with physical dolls that they sell. "Parents will be less inclined to buy their child another doll if they just saw the last one die." While that's completely fair, that is such a transition from games back in the day, or even Tamagotchi, where they were really hard. They were much, much harder. And Tamagotchis, obviously, we saw, you know, could really die. And I just think if this is a trend we're seeing, and if EA spokesperson recently who said, you know, we think all games are going to be free to play in the next however many years, like, if that's a trend we're seeing, I think there's a worrying possible scenario in which games just become incredibly unchallenging.
I think you're right in identifying that trend. That is definitely happening, and I think that there. But then at the same time, there are the certainly the hardcore games industry is rebelling against that. I mean, you saw the popularity of something like a game like Dark Souls, where like that's a game where in the tutorial you'll probably die 6 or 7 times, and that is unthinkable in any other game. Even something like Call of Duty, you don't die in the tutorial.
It is today, but that's still a game you pay for up front in advance.
Yep, absolutely.
Whereas, you know, there are different games. And this is about the, as free to play is going from casual games, Facebook games, iPhone games, things like that, into mainstream games. I mean, EA, biggest publisher in the world, and they're saying these games need to be free to play, you know, in order to survive. And I think if you put two and two together, you won't see games like Dark Souls that have that huge level of challenge.
The point is that Dark Souls has been incredibly popular within the gaming community, much, much more so than other games, because of the fact that it's so hard. That challenge is there, and gamers love to have that challenge.
Mm. But that's also a very different audience. A lot of the games we've been talking about are kind of targeted at kids.
Audience.
But I'm thinking of something like Lemmings, where you get loads of death, loads and loads of suicidal little creatures. I mean, you can compensate with something like that, and it doesn't have to be grim and gruesome and, you know, horrific head explosions. It can be, you know,
it
light
doesn't have
death.
To be. I mean, Tamagotchi's heads never exploded; they just got little diseases and then grew wings. Mm. It's more like it was such a different era in a sense, in that it was all paid up front, and so stuff like that was fine. Whereas now, developers just don't want to risk that. I mean, it's the same reason you get so many sequels and reboots, because developers, like, we're only going to invest in the stuff that we know is going to sell, so they cling on to existing IP like Tomb Raider and all this kind of stuff, rather than
so what do you think is the answer to this death question? Do you think your horse should be able to die?
Do you think
that will work on a commercial level?
I think it should. I mean, the thing is, when I was talking to these developers for this feature, they all said they considered illness or death and ruled it out because they thought it'll upset kids. And or the one interviewee who said that it was basically, we just don't want parents to see their kids upset and not spend more money with us, effectively. Yeah. And, you know, and we've seen
maybe
other things.
Maybe it's something to do with the fact that parents have responsibility for those credit cards and kids aren't getting so much pocket money anymore. And perhaps they need that parental authority to buy stuff rather than being able to go to the shop and just pick up your Tamagotchi.
Maybe, but I mean, it's we've seen it in other games. Final Fantasy VII, which was really one of the most popular RPGs of all time, was recently released for the PC this month. And in it, the game lets you max out all of your stats so you can just cruise through the game, you know, max health and max magic and all this kind of stuff. So you can just cruise through.
Mm. But then games have always had a god mode. Like Doom had a god mode in it.
But they were more like cheats. And you don't
I mean, that's a cheat as well, isn't it?
I suppose so.
Well, we did ask Twitter about this. We asked them how they felt about virtual pets being able to die. And we had a few responses. Smudged Photo, for example, said, got it upset me when my Tamagotchi went. It was a life support machine beeping. And then, beep. Very sad.
Very
true. Sad.
Who else have we got? Kurt Stavke said, if I had to watch Old Yeller in its entirety, kids can deal with digital pet death.
I think that's true. Like having digital pets die could possibly even help kids prepare for real death in the real world.
Although there is a bit of a difference, I suppose, between a dead horse and a dead...
Actual horse
or a relative.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And but Robert Haslam sort of backed that up as well. He said it's no more upsetting than finding out that Santa and the Easter Bunny don't exist. Real pets die, so virtual ones should do too.
Well, we're curious to know what you think. Facebook.com/WiredUK. Let us know what you think to this. You know, do you think our games getting easier because games developers are getting a bit desperate and greedy? Or do we not need death at all? Is death an old school thing of the past? As we all live to 1,000 years. It's been said, you know...
Is death expired?
The first person to live for 1,000 years is already alive.
It's been said. That doesn't mean it's going to happen.
I just think maybe death is just going out of, you know, out of style. You know?
Good. Immortality is the new black.
Well, that's gonna kill the news now, Duncan. It's I want to say a fond farewell. You have been a oak. You have grown up through the soil. And
he hasn't
spread
grown.
Your
he
leaves.
Can't grow anymore. He's so bloody tall.
And rained your leaves on the podcast audience for 2 years.
It's been a real pleasure, and I will miss all you guys. So thank you so much for listening over the last... How long are we doing it now? A year and a half?
Almost
like that?
2 years. We started October 2010, I think.
And I'm especially sad that I won't be still around for the 100th episode, which is only, 2 months away? Two and a half months away?
Yeah, it'll be the week of November the 1st. First week in November, I think.
Yeah, mark that in your calendars, kids.
Oh, yeah, we've got a big surprise coming for that. So we put out some messages on Twitter, didn't we? Actually, Michael Hobson said that you're much taller in real life than in your Twitter picture, and he will miss your loftiness.
Yes.
Won't we all? and what's all this about you singing Sweat a la 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 long at a party?
So this was at a karaoke thing, and it was amazing. You know the song Sweat? Yeah, the one that's like, girl, I'm going to make you sweat. That's exactly the one. And it was wonderful because in karaoke places, or in this karaoke place anyway, the videos on the screen just did not match the words at all. So while we were singing this, it was just like an Alsatian running around the screen.
Wow.
And there were all these lyrics about...
I literally just sneezed tea through my nose.
About like looking in your big brown eyes. It was absolutely fantastic. So I think that's a reference to. And I'm not sure you can... I don't think you should really read this last one out. I don't think you can.
I don't think I can.
Faintly X-rated.
I honestly have tea coming out of my nose. Literally.
That's probably for the best.
Oh, I've never done that before. That's really uncomfortable. Ow. Well, yeah, Pokey said it'll be sad to see you go.
Yeah, and I don't think you should read that second bit out.
In my thoughts as I beep tonight.
Yeah, probably... Well, the less said about that, the better.
Thank you, Pokey. Well, I'm going to let you read out how people can get in touch with the show and indeed with yourself.
If you want to get in touch with the show, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at WiredUK. We've also got a Facebook page, which we mentioned a little bit earlier. We are facebook.com/WiredUK. You can drop us an email on podcast@wired.co.uk, and you can phone us if you want to. Leave a little voice message, which I will probably be doing in the coming weeks to go, I miss you.
Oh, yeah, you should.
On 0208-123-0468. That's 0208-123-0468. And if you'd like to keep in touch with me and what I'm going to be doing from now on, you can follow me on Twitter. I am Duncan Gear, GEERE.
Duncan, it's been a pleasure. Liv, I will see you again next week. I really need to get
he's
this
crying.
Tea. No, I've got tea in my sinuses.
That's what they all say.
Honestly, if I could, I really... It's a fact. Cheers, Duncan.
Thanks, Duncan.
It's been a pleasure. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Do you want to move it slightly that way? Not really. So I don't look quite so enormous.